Oh, it's such an honor, Danny, to be a part of this amazing podcast you're doing here. And it's just really cool to be talking about this book.
That was so fun.
Yeah, it sure was, especially the quiz. Thanks for preparing that for me.
Thank you for your wonderful questions.
Best when these things just turn into a conversation.
Yeah.
Good on you for fighting the good fight too.
Oh, thank you so much. And thank you for your lovely review. I really appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you, guys.
I love your enthusiasm. I just think it's a brilliant thing you're doing, a podcast about, you know, books. And you do a lot of great interviews, so I'm really honoured to be part of it.
I so enjoy listening to the podcast. I love it. And, and it does just feel like you're having a chat with your mate.
You are listening to Words and Nerds, talking to your favourite authors.
Welcome, listeners, and thank you so much for joining us on another episode of Words and Nerds podcast. Today, I am particularly excited to be welcoming one of my favourite authors, Elliot Perlman. Elliot Perlman is a best-selling, award-winning novelist whose books have been translated around the world and adapted for film and television. The Adventures of Catwinkle is Elliot's first book for children. However, most of us probably know him for his literary fiction for adults, The Street Sweeper, $3, a collection of short stories, The Reasons I Won't Be Coming, and one of my all-time favourite novels, Seven Types of Ambiguity. Today, Elliot and I dive deeply into The Adventures of Catwinkle and Seven Types of Ambiguity. We chat about so many things in this episode, including how literary fiction can make us better and more empathetic people, toxic masculinity, how important it is to shape young minds through literature, Amsterdam as a beautiful setting for a children's story, the writing process, and how we should judge people on the content of their character. I really hope you enjoy this episode as much as I enjoyed recording it. I'm your host, Danny V. Thank you so much for your time, Elliot. I'm absolutely thrilled, and I must admit, a tad nervous to have you on the podcast to chat about your new children's book, The Adventures of Catwinkle. It's such a beautifully told story with an old world feel about it. And of course, it's very different to your previous novels.
Yes, well, firstly, thanks, Danny, so much for inviting me. And secondly, please don't be nervous. Leave that to me. and yes, look, it is different. At least superficially, for a start, it's a children's novel, and I hadn't written a children's novel before. But in a way, this is going to sound strange, but it does kind of flow from my previous books, at least thematically, and particularly The Street Sweeper, which is a large and dark, pretty heavy adult novel. It focuses on much of 20th century history, particularly the civil rights movement in the US and the Holocaust in Europe. And you might think, well, nothing could be further from that, than a children's novel, a novel for children. But because the themes of The Adventures of Catwinkle are really ones of anti-racism, anti-xenophobia, anti-homophobia, anti-misogyny, anti-bullying, really, and social inclusion. So in a sense, this might sound a bit trite, so I don't want to sound glib, I hope, but it's kind of like same message, different audience.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's how I read it as well, because I thought that there were two aspects of the book that I adored. I mean, first was the beautiful old world styling. We'll talk about that shortly. But it can be read as a story about two animals forming a friendship, but it can also be read from a much deeper perspective, where at the core of the book, like you said, is about connection and the fear of difference and bullying prejudice. So even though the ideas came from your previous books, which were our adult literature, how does your writing process differ when writing for children?
Well, for a start, in a sense, much freer in one sense, and that is freer to be funny and freer to, not to make sense, but that's not accurate. You must make sense, obviously, in a children's novel, but you're free to create the rules of the sense that you make, if that makes sense.
It does.
what I mean is that obviously if I write an adult novel, it has to conform to the logic of the world that you know. And even if I'm writing about a time and a place that you either haven't experienced or haven't read much about or might not even know much about, still you'll have a sense of the way the adult world works. But in writing a children's story, I've created the world. I mean, it's set in Amsterdam, which is a real place, as we know, but there are animals roaming around Amsterdam who talk, and even a cat who flies. And, you know, these things, and there are animals in Amsterdam that one wouldn't ordinarily find in Amsterdam. So all of this is kind of like my take on Amsterdam for children, a kind of a whimsical, fantastical Amsterdam, largely based on the real Amsterdam, but not entirely. And therefore, because I've sort of stretched the notion of Amsterdam, it's now my Amsterdam, and I'm free to create the logic of that world, whereas in the adult world, I'm much more constrained. But then on the other hand, I am definitely much more constrained by particularly something like vocabulary. You know, as you'll know from your background in education, you have to choose your language very carefully to target it towards the age group that you're trying to reach. And I'm no expert in this because you know, this is my first novel for children, and it was an incredibly long time since I was that age. And I do have two kids of my own, but they're tiny. 3.5 and 2 and a bit. So that explains why my words might slur and there might be gaps in my thought processes, because they don't always let me sleep. But yeah, so I'm kind of a long way away from the target audience's world. So I was, in a sense, taking quite a leap. And that's where I had to depend on my editor to tell me if I was sort of hitting the right notes in terms of the word choice. But my goal was to use language that was just a little bit above what one might expect kids of that age could comfortably grab onto, based on my, I don't know, view. Well, you know, it's not an educated view, but my feeling is that if we have some words that are just a tiny bit beyond words that children of that age would use, then they grab hold of these words and they absorb them, and it can become part of, if not their vernacular, then part of their understanding. And so, you know, I never thought as a reader, as the kid, that something was too, you know, hard for me, even though it might have been. I wanted to reach for it. I felt challenged by that. And so it was a definite attempt not to write down to the kids, but also to be conscious that, you know, you weren't free to just use any language as you are with adults.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with that. I think it's really important to, you know, show kids different types of vocabulary and expose them to these things. So I think you're absolutely right. And I love the idea of giving, you know, having more freedom in that writing process, because I didn't think of that before, because with a children's book, you kind of want to add a bit of joy to it as well.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's, you know, for me, that was the biggest fun, you know. It's perhaps the most fun I've ever had sitting down. It really is. I so enjoyed it. And the prospect of making children laugh, just really, frankly, I found it thrilling.
I loved particularly the National Kitten Baby Shoe Dancing Competition. Can I ask where that came from?
Well, again, being the father of fairly young kids, I'm quite close in time to baby shoes. And I thought, you know, on the one hand, we want to put them on the feet of our tiny children, but they also, they're kind of ridiculous because they're not going to last very long. And your kids are hardly ever, you know, they're usually worn by children who can't even walk yet. So they sort of don't need them. And that led me to think, well, what else could you do with them? I suppose kitten paws would fit in very nicely. That's sort of the way my thought process went.
I like that thought process. I thought it was very funny reading it as an adult. And I just had to say, where did that idea come from?
Yeah, well, that's sort of where it came from. You know?
And look, kids love to be barefoot anyway. They're just a waste of time, aren't they?
Yeah, well, yes. I mean, I can even understand if there was some kind of covering for the knees. But,
yes.
But babies having things around their shoes, it's almost, I don't know, it's like putting earmuffs on them.
Now, we're talking about writing a book for children with those really important ideas at its core. But like we said, we want kids to think as well as find joy in reading. Was that a difficult balancing act for you with this book?
Look, I was very much motivated. I mean, I can't put that too highly, by the challenge of getting these themes across to kids. Essentially, you know, I spent 5.5 years writing The Street Sweeper, which is the adult novel before before this novel, and you know, I went to the south side of Chicago, and I had 6 trips to Auschwitz, and then I was promoting the book, and finally, when it was all done, the world had become worse in the sense of more racist, or at the very least, there was a greater tolerance for racism and bigotry of all kinds, and you just felt that bullying and a kind of nasty groupthink was ever more prevalent and unbridled and unrestrained. And I felt angry, and I felt helpless, impotent, and despondent, you know, in a kind of despair. And I thought, where do you even start to combat this? And then through a range of circumstances, including, you know, the arrival of my own 2 kids and also something that my niece said, I thought, well, there's the answer. The answer is children. You start with children.
Wow. And that's what compelled you to write this book.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I had the idea many years ago when I was touring. I was in Amsterdam on a Dutch book tour for 7 Types of Ambiguity, which is the adult novel before The Street Sweeper. And I had a little bit of time off, and I was going for a walk at around Amsterdam, and I've been to Amsterdam quite a few times, and I love it. It's one of my favourite cities. And, you know, I thought that the streets around the canals, the old part, old central Amsterdam, is just so exquisitely beautiful and otherworldly in the sense of looking like the backdrop of a children's story. Have you ever been there?
Yeah, I love Amsterdam. My family, I come from Dutch heritage, so it was lovely to read a book about Holland and a book set in Amsterdam. And I was thinking, how many books have I read set in Amsterdam? I couldn't think of one. So it was lovely reading it because a lot of my family still live there. And it is, it's a beautiful and underrated place, I think. It's just such, and the sense of community there in Holland is just incredible.
I felt the same way. I just felt a real affinity with Amsterdam. There are many, you know, beautiful cities, but Amsterdam, I think when people sort of get bitten by it, they, you know, smitten by it, they really never want to, you know, I keep wanting to go back. And I thought that the, you know, while there are many cities and places that are beautiful, Amsterdam looked like the backdrop to a children's novel. You didn't have to invent it. It was waiting for your story. And then while on a walk, I saw in a window, let me step back a bit. If you're of Dutch origin, you might Do you speak any Dutch at all?
Nothing significant. I was lazy. I wanted to every time I went over there, but everyone spoke English, so I became really lazy.
Well, that's probably another reason why I love it so much, because, you know, they speak English better than most of us.
It's true.
But they speak it, you know, they sound so educated, and it's such a refined accent when they speak English. You know, this is a bit of a love letter to Dutch people, I know, but what I did notice was that so many places and shops had the word winkel, and it's spelled in Dutch W-I-N-K-L-E. And I asked, you know, somebody, I see this word winkel all the time. What does it mean? And they said, well, it's winkel and it means shop. And, you know, so if you saw the word, now I'm not going to remember it, but if you saw the word for cheese in Dutch.
Kaas.
Kaas, that's right, yes. Yeah, so it would be almost, you know, Kaaswinkel, and that's the cheese shop. And you know, things like that started to make sense for me. And so with that in mind, I'm going for a walk along the lovely part of central Amsterdam, along the canals near where I was staying, in an hour or two that I had off. And I saw in a bay window the most exquisite, blissed out, totally content living creature I'd ever seen, and it was a white fluffy cat. And I have to confess that while I've had some very good relationships with a few cats in my life, I did grow up more of a dog person. In fact, Eula, the character of Eula, the Dalmatian in The Adventures of Cat Finkel, was based on my Dalmatian as a boy whose name was Eula. But I saw this blissed out cat in the window, the bay window of in Amsterdam. And again, as you'll remember from your trip to Amsterdam, from your visits to Amsterdam, many things are in the windows of of Amsterdam. But this was an utterly gorgeous white fluffy cat that was asleep and blissed out in the sunshine, with the sun pouring through the window. And I thought, well, that's not a pet shop, because there are no other animals, it's just a cat. So with a cat dominating the window, I guess it's a cat winkel.
I love this.
That's how I came to think, well, she's cat winkel. That's how she appears to me. And then I thought, you know, as a writer tends to do, well, what would be the event that would totally turn around the situation for this cat, that would cause distress and concern and anxiety for this cat? And it would be the sudden appearance of a dog. And that's where I got the idea from. And at the time, I was based in New York. I was living in New York, and my sister and her family had temporarily moved to Bristol in the UK, and my little niece was at that time only 4, and I didn't know her very well because I'd been living in Amsterdam and she was so young when I would come back home to Australia. And I went from Amsterdam to Bristol to see my sister and her family. And on the very first day, my little niece, who was then 4, wanted me to take her for a walk, which I did. And I remember holding her hand, she asked me to tell her a story, because what's the point of having an uncle that's a writer? He's not going to give you a, you know, impromptu story whenever you ask for it. And I began to tell her the story of this Dutch cat called Cat Winkel, and how a dog moved in. And it had the seeds of what became the novel of Cat Winkel. And over the years, she didn't forget it. And, you know, as a little girl, she would draw the characters even. And she was always asking me, or telling me, really, you've got to write down the story of Cat Winkel. And I wanted to do it, but I had the street sweeper to research and write. And then she saw the state of the world as I did, and she said, well, now I think it's really time to write down the story of Cat Winkel. And, of course, by this stage, She's 17.
And that must be the dedication at the back of your book.
That's right.
At the back, beautiful.
I thank her, yes. Oh, she kept the story alive.
That's so lovely, because I was, when I read, you know, that at the end, I was like, oh, I wonder who this book has been, you know, I wonder who this person is. So that's such a lovely story.
Thank you. Yeah, it's all true. Well, I owe a lot to her.
So how did you channel Kat Winkle's voice, a sassy little cat?
Well, she's a bit cheeky and a little bit mischievous and not a little bit selfish, and even fairly manipulative. And I think we all have a little bit of that in us to a greater or lesser extent. And even if we have a little bit of it, we recognize other people that have more of it in us. And so, frankly, it wasn't difficult to... I could just see her being that way. And I think, you know, she fits the image we have of certain cats. and cat lovers have told me, oh, yeah, you've got her. Which is, you know, very gratifying.
I also have to say, I love the references to backgammon, another really underrated game. And this is a game I play with my dad as a kid constantly. And you never hear about backgammon.
I know, it's funny. It was huge at a certain time. I think you're probably too young to have been around and playing it when it was absolutely at its height. But I'm pleased to hear that you played it. Yeah, look, you know, like so many things, it will probably get big again. And maybe it'll get big again through Kat Winkle, because there's a certain animal that is very keen to play it all the time.
Maybe we need to put backgammon on the Xbox or something.
That would be a good idea.
I've still got the backgammon game in the little suitcase that I had as a child that I played with my dad.
They were very... elegant little sets,
they
weren't
are.
They?
Yeah. It's falling apart by now. Look, doesn't look very elegant now, but it has so much sentimental value. I'm not throwing it away.
No, you've got to keep it.
Now, the book is about embracing difference and accepting who you are, and it's just such a wonderful motif for young readers. But along the way, there are challenges to self-acceptance, and I thought these quotes were so sad. Kat Winkle states, "It would make things much easier if just by eating salmon we could turn you into a cat." And later a character says, "I'll be happy if they accept me for who I'm pretending to be." There's both humour and real sadness to these ideas, because I think we've all felt like that at times, haven't we?
Oh, absolutely. And that was one of the things I want to get across to children. Yes, I mean, we've been in positions where you're thinking, particularly at school, but even as adults, unfortunately, we're putting on a face, we're putting on a mask, and you're just hopeful that the mask works, rather than thinking, I'd really like people to accept me for who I am. You'll be gratified, or you know, you'll accept, you'll be prepared to take them accepting you for who you're pretending to be. And you're right, that is, I hope it's a bit funny, but yes, it is sad, and I thought children would get it. I had a really heartwarming experience. Last week I was in Sydney to promote Kat Winkle, and a bookseller told me that she was reading it to her niece, and her niece had been brought up by her parents to be very accepting and open and honest and friendly, and essentially an open-hearted little girl with everyone she came into contact with. And when she started school, particularly a few years in, she saw that not every other child was that way, and it hurt her, and she didn't know how you could continue to be as she'd been taught to be and still survive socially. And she was quite distressed by this, and her aunt was reading her a chapter a night of Kat Winkle, and not only was the little girl liking it, which was, you know, wonderful enough for me to hear, but it was giving her confidence when she went to school. Somehow, I don't know if she was identifying with Kat Winkle and Eula, and it was making her feel maybe braver, or just a bit more immune, impervious to some of the nastiness, and maybe just to convince her that whatever's going on, you're right.
Mm-hmm.
It might not be easy for you, but you're definitely doing the right thing. You're doing the brave thing to be open-hearted and accepting and standing up to bullies.
And isn't that nice when you can see yourself in literature? And isn't that why literature is so important from childhood to, you know, adulthood?
Oh, Danny, I can tell you that's the best thing I've heard, you know, and frankly, obviously, as a professional writer, I need to survive financially. But the biggest gift I've been given with Katwinkle is hearing that story that from that little girl.
Mm. And Katwinkle states, if you're friends with the mean cats, you think they won't be mean to you. And this idea of keeping your enemies close isn't a new one. But then if you take no action against bullies or if you befriend them, you become complicit to some degree. And that's so difficult for kids just starting school because there's so much to navigate. But I thought that was just another important idea to bring to the forefront.
Oh, absolutely. I'm glad you saw that and picked up on it. In fact, I would like to, I don't know how to do it, and I don't really have the influence, unfortunately, but I'd like to sort of champion a movement that says you'd find very few sane adult Australians that didn't think it was an excellent idea to teach our kids to swim as early as possible. And you know, whether it's government schools or our education system generally, pretty much everyone's all for that. Well, equally, I would like to champion a movement, or an idea at least, that says children should be taught to recognise all of the things we mentioned before, that, you know, racism, xenophobia, homophobia, misogyny, bullying in general, taught to recognise it and to eschew it and to fight against it, even when you are not the target or you're not part of a group that is the target, because, as you alluded to before, Danny, if we all stand up against the bully, then there can't be a bully. The bully requires either people to be silent or people to join in.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And as an adult and an English teacher, this book was so reflective of so many issues that we face, and you've mentioned them before, but, you know, marriage equality, and I was thinking people seeking refuge from their place of birth, I mean, how much of an important issue is that to us and around the world? Fear of other cultures and pretty much any collective group of people who've been feared or discriminated against. And I thought, this is such a great children's book because, like I said, you can read it at face value or it can open doors for further discussion. And I guess, you know, literature should be influential and it should encourage people to think and dream, and it should help to shape the young people, because that's who is ahead of us, isn't it? That's who is going to be shaping the future for us.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, my idea was to, the plan was to entertain kids and make them laugh and make them happy and also make them want to turn the pages, but at the same time to plant these thoughts and these messages, and then with any luck, teachers and librarians and parents and grandparents and aunts and uncles can explore these other issues with them, you know, as depending on their age level, to get deeper and deeper, and to make the point that difference isn't good or bad, it's just different.
Mm-hmm.
And that you should, you know, again, to quote Martin Luther King, judge people on the content of their character, not on where they come from, what they look like, what they believe. And, yeah, the idea that I think is stated maybe on the back of the book is that it says if you're not open to adventure, you might never meet your best friend. And really, if you're not open-minded, open-hearted, you're missing out on so much richness in the world, quite apart from causing yourself so much distress, because it's not healthy for you to be hating or to be fearful.
That's so beautiful. I love that. I love that open-heartedness and open-mindedness, because that opens you up to new experiences. I love that.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, I'm not naive enough to think, you know, all people are, you know, worthy of our friendship, but certainly they're not unworthy by virtue of a particular group that they come from.
Mm-hmm. Now, the book is so much about making personal connections with others, often in order to overcome fear. And something that really stuck with me was an idea examined by Alain de Botton. He argues that there once existed a degree of neighbourliness that has been replaced by ruthless anonymity. And because of this, we lose compassion and empathy for others. And I thought this was true in your story as well.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I think we have to, you know, empathy is like a social muscle that we need to exercise. And that's part of what I was suggesting with a, you know, some kind of movement towards encouraging it, recognizing that these problems exist and getting people to be sensitive to them and so they can protect against it. And not, it shouldn't be the, if kids are educated to be sensitive to sensitive to racism and xenophobia and homophobia and misogyny and bullying, then the, you know, their antennae will be up and they'll guard against it and they'll be less likely to fall for it, and then there's nothing to stop people from being friends, except, as I said, the content of their characters. And in terms of the anonymity, well, you know, the digital age is frankly plus minus. There's definitely some downside to it. And if it stops interactions with people, that's a negative thing. And also it's become a, you know, social media, it's very well documented, has become a repository of viciousness, and it's not impossible, obviously, but it's much harder to express that to people that you can actually see.
Yeah, I read an article too that said that too much social media, or, you know, not enough human interaction, actually decreases one's empathy. And I often think, because this is obviously the first time that any generation has had all this social media and, you know, been behind a screen so much. And I do wonder, and I talk about this all the time, but I think, what is the long-term impact? Are we going, in 50 years' time, are people going to look back at us and go, wow, they really screwed everything up? Like, it's a fear.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. I mean, you can definitely see that coming with climate change, but you're quite right. I mean, to wonder, I know that you'll have certain people saying that in every age, you know, people were worried about the printing press and people were worried about
the television,
radio, and then television, and then, you know, but the fact that there have been concerns which proved to be unfounded doesn't mean this is unfounded, and it does appear to be a more fundamental change in the way we interact with each other than any of the previous media that we just outlined. So, yeah, I think it's quite appropriate to be concerned about this. So, yes, in my own kind of anemic way, Katwinkle was me kind of trying to do something about it.
And there is no social media. Eula and Katwinkle are not texting each other, so that's a great thing. They're not on Twitter.
No, they're not. They have to deal with each other snout to snout.
Just so great. Now, the illustrations by Laura Stitzel, they are beautiful, as is the hardcover. I just love touching this book. It's so old world and gorgeous. How did you work with an illustrator so it fit the vision you had of the book?
Well, I mean, for a start, I have to confess I didn't know Laura's work. And when I went to Puffin with the novel, you know, I said, I think it should be illustrated. And they agreed immediately. And then they said, do you have anyone in mind? And I said, not really. I can sort of imagine how it would look. But they sent me a list of some half a dozen illustrators that I guess, obviously, they were happy to work with. And I looked at all their work and I thought, I just loved Laura's work. I loved her animals in particular. And I thought, yes, you know, I think I hadn't met her yet, hadn't spoken to her yet, but you could see in her work that it was very likely she would do a wonderful job. And then, you know, we met through the publisher, and we had lots of conversations about the characters and Katwinkel, and it was so much fun working with her. And I got so excited. Firstly, I don't normally collaborate with anyone, which is something I miss and would like to do. And secondly, I'd never seen my characters illustrated or animated. You know, there've been film and TV versions of my adult novels, mm-hmm. but it very much gets filtered between, you know, between the novel and what ends up coming on the screen. But here I was working with the illustrator, albeit it's entirely her work, and she's incredibly, incredibly talented and really got the story, but at least I could say tiny little things, little suggestions, like I think Eula's snout might be a bit longer. and then there'd be a three-way conversation between our editor Zoe and Laura and me about, for example, Roy Lama's snout and ears, and the ears of a llama. You know, I don't normally get to talk about that and call it work, but here I did. So I was just, I felt I'd really, you know, landed in gold working with Laura. She's just so talented, and she got it. You know, she could, the whimsy and the sort of slight silliness, and she's done such a great job with Katwinkel. When you see Katwinkel dance, it's just delightful. I think, you know, you could practically get people to read the book just if you saw that one illustration. Think, oh, I want to know more about this sassy little dancing cat.
I just love holding the book. It's one of my favourite books to touch. It's such a tactile experience with the cover and the illustrations. It's just beautiful.
Isn't it lovely to have a nice, substantial hardback children's novel? I'm really so delighted with the production job that Puffin have done with it.
Moving on to something different, this podcast is nearly 1 year old. I started it on the 31st of October last year. And for an entire year, you have been on the top of my interview wish list.
Oh, thank you. Wow.
Now,
you should have told sooner.
Well, Seven Types of Ambiguity has been one of my favourite novels for about 15 years now. And what's been a really interesting experience for me was that I first read it as a young single woman, and then I reread it as a mother, not so young anymore. And it was so interesting to me how differently I read it and how my understanding and empathy for characters shifted. For example, I found myself having less empathy for Simon and more for Anna's husband. But what resonated with me about this book most of all, and others I can see from social media, is your observations of humanity and relationships and how these ideas continue to resonate with readers. I know this book was published, you know, back in 2003, but how do you feel all these years later about the observations and how they still resonate with others?
Look, I'm delighted that people still read it and talk about it. It's interesting that you had this different reaction to the characters. My goal with each of these characters, and for people who haven't read it, it's a novel told in seven parts, where each part is a different character. And although it has been described as sort of Rashomonian, meaning like the classic Japanese movie Rashomon, and I think when people have used that, they mean to be complimentary, but it's slightly misleading or incorrect, mm-hmm. because in Rashomon, it's the same story told three different times through three different characters. Mm-hmm. But here, it's not the same story because each character progresses the story.
Yep.
There will be slight moments, threads, where you think, we heard that, but in a slightly different way or with a slightly different perspective. But it's certainly not the same story told seven times, because that would be boring. but it was my intention with each of the characters to not have any of them be totally likable or totally unlikable. And to a certain extent, it's a reflection of the reader where their heart goes, or who's the character that they most relate to. I mean, obviously, I had a lot of sympathy for Simon, but perhaps even more for Alex. And I was very surprised. I thought when the book came out, I thought people, particularly women, particularly young women, are going to hate the character of Joe. And I was very pleasantly surprised to see how much sympathy they had for him. I was shocked. And the other thing, you know, Simon is sort of the, Byronic romantic hero, apparently, and he's very, socially progressive, and he looks like he's, brimming with love, compassion, and empathy. But in fact, he hurts a lot of people. And by being sort of so certain, almost arrogant in his belief that he has a virtual monopoly on compassion, he does hurt a lot of people. And one could easily understand the reader being frustrated with him.
Mm-hmm.
And Joe, on the surface of it, looks to be the opposite of him. But you end up, I hope, having some sympathy for him as well. So I guess the suggestion in the novel is no one is totally moral and no one is totally immoral, very few people, and we're all screwed up and all frightened and uncertain and making our way, and we are in many respects prisoners of the systems that we're living in, you know, at the risk of getting too political. You see the distortionary effects of money on the behaviour of many of the characters in the novel.
Yeah. Coming from seven different perspectives, everyone has their own truth. You know what was terrifying for me, like loving this book so much when it was published? You know sometimes when you reread a book and you're like, oh, it's not really how I remembered it. So when I reread it, it definitely was, and I still love it. It's still one of my favourite books, but it was just funny how you could just see the characters in a different way because you were in a different place. And isn't that interesting? You can read the same book in different ways just because a decade has passed. I love that.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I remember my mum, like you, my mum was an English teacher, used to laugh, but and she told a very sweet story of teaching, I think it might have been Lord of the Flies, and she taught Lord of the Flies to maybe year seven, and then she taught it again to a group of year 11s, and some of the kids in year 11 were the same kids she had taught the book to in year seven.
Wow.
And she told the story that the year 11 kids said, yes, we did this in year seven. We read it again. And one kid said, Golding's got better. William Golding, the author, his writing's got better. Yeah.
And that's what's so wonderful about literature, isn't it? Not only can other people view the text differently, you can too as your life goes on.
That's right, exactly. Which can show you that, and look, I think it's the same with all art, that we have to be in the right frame of mind when we come to it. And it's not just a matter of, you know, when you're a child, maybe something that might be a difficult pleasure is too difficult for you, but you can have phases very definitely in your adult life where things are going on and maybe there are crises going on, or you just don't have the mental space to absorb something, and then later on, whether it's months or years later, you do. And a work that seemed obtuse or difficult, or you know, you didn't have the patience for it. And I've been in this situation too, where you think I know this is probably excellent, but I, you know, right now I just need to lie on the couch and watch the football. I can't do it. I've got to come back to this later.
Yep.
You know, poetry's like that. Mm-hmm. You've got to be in the right frame of mind for that. And you know, a lot of really fantastic fiction, literary fiction, is like that too.
Yeah, absolutely. And the book, even though, you know, it has been out for a really long time, it still resonates with people. And when you look on the internet, the quotes still come up. And now we want to clear something up about one of these quotes. One of my favorite quotes: what is it about men that makes women so lonely? Now, this has been repeatedly misquoted.
Yeah, well, it's really funny because on the one hand, I'm very flattered that people say it so often, and they write it. And but I think what happened is that, you know, when my work first started to be quoted on the internet, there was just a typo, and they left the S off it, and so it read, "What is it about men that make women so lonely?" And the you know, correct quote is, "What is it about men that makes women so lonely?"
Such a small thing, but such a difference.
Yeah, well,
such a grammatical difference.
It looks like I made a mistake, and I didn't. You know, I'm not there anyway.
From a man's perspective, like, was this some quote that just sort of you didn't think much about, or was it something like, how do you come up with that from a male perspective? I was talking about this with my female friends, and like, is this a guy who wrote this? I was like, yeah, yeah. So they wanted to know, how do you come up with this?
Men have got a lot to answer for. They do, and it you know, as a man, I don't get how. Well, I suppose, I mean, I can explain it after the fact, or attempt to explain why men think they can get away with not expressing themselves, or you know, grunting their way through life. And you know, I think it's starting to change. You know, maybe too late and too slowly, but. To not be able to express their emotions, and to not be able to handle differences of opinion without becoming bellicose, or and to not be more accepting and open-minded. And of course, not all men are like that, obviously. I mean, it's ridiculous to generalize about half the population. But to the extent that you find that more, and of course you'll find those negative attributes, you know, with women as well. But to the extent that you find it more often in men, and I would stick my neck out and say a lot more often in men, it's frustrating even as a man. Because you see, I'm supposed to be friends with, I mean, I have a lot of, and I think I've always had a lot of female friends, platonic friends, but, you know, I never understood why is it somehow an attack on your masculinity to admit emotion, and to, you know, to be willing to obviously go the distance and extend a hand in empathy.
Mm.
How did it become that we would say, oh, that's a man expressing his feminine side? It's the human side.
Mm.
Why? And to the extent that it is the feminine side, because it's more often, more frequently expressed by women, it makes me as a man angry with men. And this is not even a comment on misogyny even. It's just...
Had they read more books when they were children, they would have gained more empathy and be a better person.
Yeah, well, I think that's true as well. And how did it become the case that you can't, that a desire to be good at sport can't coexist with a desire to be enriched by literature?
Mm, it's a strange culture, and we can only try and shape the young people that are in our, you know, company now to be different.
Oh, absolutely. And so, you know, I'm very keen to get boys reading and reading poetry.
Mm.
And there's nothing to be embarrassed about wanting to know more about the world and to be taken to other places and have your experiences enriched and your emotions nurtured and nourished by art generally.
I found slam poetry has been a way in for boys. They really like that. There's a lot of that on either TED or YouTube. So that's been a way in for boys to, you know, be okay with those kind of mediums.
Yes, exactly. I'm very hopeful that that can sort of break down some barriers, as long as it doesn't just stop there and turn into
rapping.
kind of a competitive, aggressive
rap battle. Is that what they call
it? Beat each other up.
A rap battle, as long as it doesn't turn into that.
yeah. I mean, and this is coming from someone that loves football. My mother used to say to me when she'd see me, you know, engrossed in an Australian rules football game, and I used to play some football, even not terribly well, but earnestly, and she'd say, I just don't get it. You watch the footy and yet you also read poetry. And I said, where is the contradiction in that?
Where were the rules to say I can't do both?
Yeah, exactly.
That's wonderful. And, of course, going back to seven types of ambiguity, my favourite passage, no other author has given me a favourite passage about toast.
Toast and love.
Oh, I love that quote so much. It's quite long, but I'm going to read it anyway. You don't mind, do you? Unless you can memorise your own work.
I don't memorize it, then you're welcome to read it. As long as you don't add a grammatical imperfection, isn't there.
Oh, no pressure. You'll stop me if I do, right?
Okay.
I love this. It's like the smell of burned toast. You make the toast. You look forward to it. You even enjoyed making it, but it burned. What were you doing? Was it your fault? It doesn't matter anymore. You open the window, but only the very top layer of the smell goes away. The rest remains around you. It's in the walls. You leave the room, but it's on your clothes. You change your clothes, but it's in your hair. It's on the thin skin on the tops of your hand. And in the morning, it's still there. When do we stop talking about toast in there? It just goes from toast to love to it's an amazing passage. I love it.
Oh, thank you.
I read it to people all the time and they're like, never thought about toast in that way. It's a new experience.
it's the burning of the toast.
I know.
It's the That's kind of how you feel about, you know, broken romantic relationships, that you do everything you can to try and get over it. Sometimes you think you are over it, you're nearly over it, and then guess what? You're not over it.
Yeah, it's just there. It's there on your skin and in your hands and you can't get rid of it. I love that. It reminded me of Lady Macbeth a bit as well.
Well, yeah, the damn spot, yes.
Yes, our damn spot.
She has... for her, it's guilt.
Yes, but it could be anything. You know, this toast analogy. You know, I read it from the context of the book being of love, but you know, I was also thinking lost opportunity or guilt, or you know, it can be read in any way on its own.
Oh, absolutely, yes, and regret too.
Yes, absolutely. So, children's book. You've written a number of adult fiction, literary fiction. What's next for you, Elliot?
Well, as long as my children let me, I will be delivering my next adult novel in the next few weeks.
Oh, wow.
All going well, short of, you know, illness and catastrophe. So that should be out, I think, in the second half of next year.
Oh, my goodness. I'm so excited about that. I'll be bugging you to speak to me again about it.
Well, I hope you will. I'd love to talk to you again about it. If I haven't blown it this one.
I'm very excited. Thank you so much, Elliot. I cannot thank you enough. Like I said, this has been a bit of a podcast goal for me, speaking to you, and such a pleasure to talk to you not only about your new book, The Adventures of Catwinkle, but one of my absolute all-time favourites. I still, when people say, what are your top five books? And I will tell you, it's Seven Types of Ambiguity. So it's right up there with my top five, you know, so I still say that. And it's been so wonderful talking to you about your work.
Thank you, Danny. It really has been a pleasure. I mean that.
Thank you so much, Elliot.
You are listening to Words and Nerds, talking to your favourite authors.